Hey everybody, welcome to this month's episode of Ankle Surgery Update, Science Guiding Treatment. Thank you so much for tuning in again. We hope you will find the following paper picks interesting. As always, you can find the podcast on all common platforms, and feel free to join us at FooSprueLMU. The picks for this session are Magnetic Resonance Imaging and Outcomes of Osteochondral Lesions of the Talus Associated with Ankle Fractures by Sechin Özegan and colleagues, published in Foot & Ankle International. For the second part, we actually picked two papers on arthroscopic reconstruction in chronic lateral ankle instability. One study is entitled All Inside Endoscopic Anatomic Reconstruction Leads to Satisfactory Functional Outcomes in Patients with Chronic Ankle Instability by Guillo et al., published in Kester. The second study is entitled Arthroscopic Assisted versus All Arthroscopic Ankle Stabilization Technique by Gulfi et al., published in Foot & Ankle International. So, let's take it from here. The first study of this episode is entitled Magnetic Resonance Imaging and Outcomes of Osteochondral Lesions of the Talus Associated with Ankle Fractures by Sechin Özegan et al., published in Foot & Ankle International. Concomitant chondral lesions and ankle fractures, to us, is one of the most discussed topics in ankle fracture care right now. Ankle fractures are frequent and often doomed educational operations for residents, but the outcome, especially with increasing complexity, is far from optimal. One reason for those inferior outcomes could be untreated intra-articular pathologies. Özegan and colleagues conducted a prospective study on the incidence of osteochondral lesions after ankle fracture treatment and their clinical relevance at early follow-up. 30 patients were treated operatively, 26 non-operatively. 56 consecutive patients with a mean age of 45 plus minus 13 years were prospectively enrolled. Post-operative MRI using a 1.5 Tesla scanner were performed in the second month after injury. Osteochondral lesions were classified according to Happel et al. In patients with an osteochondral lesion that were symptomatic for more than 6 months, revision surgery was considered. The patient-rated outcome was assessed at 2 months and second year using the AOFAS. The quality of reduction was rated as anatomical in about 70% of patients, whereas the reduction in the remaining patients was acceptable. No delayed or non-union occurred. Osteochondral lesions occurred in 35% of patients, with a vast majority, almost 80%, being chondral lesions. One patient suffered a displaced chondral lesion and was treated by microfracturing 6 months following the initial procedure. Interestingly, the occurrence of an osteochondral lesion was not affected by the fracture mechanism, the fracture severity per the Dennis Weber or Lager-Hansen classification, an unstable syndesmotic injury, or the treatment methods, i.e. conservative or operative treatment. But osteochondral lesions occurred significantly more often in patients with an acceptable compared to an anatomical reduction. Let's have a look at the clinical outcome. Although patients with an osteochondral lesions had a significant higher IOFAS score in the second postoperative month, no significant differences were observed in the second postoperative year. At this final follow-up, the mean AOFAS score was 81 plus minus 7 points in those patients with an osteochondral lesion and 86 plus minus 8 points without osteochondral lesions. Interestingly, they did not find a significant decrease for the OCL group p equals 0.026 and a significant increase for patients without an OCL p smaller 0.001 between the second year compared to the second month control.
Thanks, Sebastian. Ankle fractures are common, and we strongly believe that osteochondral lesions are a major issue. Actually, several societies already recommend arthroscopic assisted treatment for ankle fractures. Still, recent studies analyzing insurance databases showed that just about 1% of patients suffering an ankle fracture are actually treated arthroscopically assisted. To me, the greatest aspect about this study is its prospective design. I strongly want to encourage the authors that they further follow up these patients. It does give us the unique opportunity to see the natural course of these intra-articular lesions and their effect on the patient-rated outcome. We actually started arthroscopic-assisted surgery for more complex ankle fractures several years ago and have published our one-year results of 32 patients. At 1 year follow-up, the median AOFAS score was 94 points and the OMAS score 90 points. But in contrast to the study by Özkan and colleagues, did we assess the chondral lesions by direct visualization during arthroscopy and treated any ICRS grade 4 lesion by microfracturing? This could explain the difference of about 10 points in the AOFAS score between the two studies. In our cohort, 91% of patients had some sort of chondral lesions, but full thickness lesions were observed only in bi- and trimalleolar fractures at a rate of about 40%, but not in unimalleolar fractures. Sebastian, you said Özkan et al. Used the Happel classification. Do you think this could be a limitation of their study?
That is a great point, Hans. The classification by Happel et al. Is a broad classification for osteochondral lesions. This classification grades as follows. Type 1 are chondral lesions. Type 2A and B are cartilage injuries and bony fracture with or without bony edema. Type 3 and 4 are detached bony fragments, displaced or non-displaced. And type 5 are subchondral cysts. But the vast majority of lesions observed by Özkan et al. Were chondral lesions, just as we did. But these were not further subclassified. You introduced our study in which we did differentiate the observed chondral lesions by the ICRS classification. Using this classification, we were able to show that full thickness cartilage lesions, thus lesions that necessitate treatment, are more common in bi- and trimalleolar fractures. Maybe the authors should, for the next follow-up study, differentiate their chondral lesions per the ICRS classification. Or what do you think?
I fully agree. But I would like to address one more general point. I think we both agree that we are not too happy about the way the term osteochondral lesions is used. Most authors, as done in this study also, use this term osteochondral lesion inconsistently. To me, when talking about ankle fractures, we should talk about intra-articular pathologies. These include loose bodies, soft tissue lesions, chondral lesions, and osteochondral lesions. Osteochondral lesions, to me, are a different entity compared to chondral lesions. Moreover, their treatment is completely different. Whereas non-displaced fragments can be treated non-surgically, displaced fragments necessitate early surgery and refixation. Therefore, these are rather treated as fractures. There is one more thing I would like to briefly discuss. The authors use plain radiographs to classify their fractures and to assess the quality of postoperative reduction. To us, we must ask for preoperative CT scans, not only to safely classify these fractures, but also to make a sound treatment plan. One study actually compared preoperative planning based on radiographs and on CT scans. If I remember correctly, planning on CT scans resulted in a change in the treatment plan in about 20-30%. Finally, we also conduct postoperative CT scans whenever we address syndesmotic instability. In case we do a bony refixation of the posterior and/or anterior syndesmosis, we conduct unilateral CT scans. In case of a pure ligamentous syndesmotic instability, we even conduct a bilateral CT scan to assess the reduction of the fibula into the tibial notch.
Thank you very much, Hans. As stated initially, I believe that the biggest value of this study is its design, a natural history study. This means it does investigate the course of a disease, in this case, osteochondral and chondral lesions, without any intervention. I believe both of us are very excited to see 5-year results. This might give us a distinct idea on how patients with or without an osteochondral lesions progress over time. Furthermore, it again does highlight the frequency of intra-articular pathologies in ankle fractures.
Thanks, Sebastian, for the nice sum up. But there's one more thing I would like to state. Özkan et al. Treated a patient with a 6-month-old osteochondral lesion by microfracturing. They did not present the images of this case, and therefore, we do not know the actual morphology of the lesion. But in case of an actual chronic osteochondral lesion, one should address the bony defect as well as the cartilage. In this case, we prefer to do an AMIC, but this is a whole new discussion.
Thanks, Hans. That is an important comment, and the whole topic of chronic as well as acute treatment of osteochondral lesions does most likely fill more than one episode. But let's have a look at the next two papers we chose for this episode. Both deal with arthroscopic repair for chronic lateral ankle instability, right?
Before you start with the paper presentation, Sebastian, chronic lateral ankle instability is a topic that fits well to the first paper. In chronic lateral ankle instability, accompanying chondral and osteochondral lesions are well accepted. For my understanding, the discussion on doing an arthroscopic or open stabilization for chronic lateral ankle instability is not closed, but the vast majority of researchers and colleagues agree that due to the high frequency of intra-articular lesions, any patient treated for chronic lateral ankle instability should be scoped prior to the stabilization. But now please present the paper to us.
Thanks for this comment, Hans. And just to ensure you before we start, both papers did arthroscopy prior to the procedure. But let's see what we actually picked. The first of the two papers I would like to present is entitled All Inside Endoscopic Anatomic Reconstruction Leads to Satisfactory Functional Outcomes in Patients with Chronic Ankle Instability, and was just published in Kesta. There are multiple open arthroscopic techniques described for anatomical reconstruction in chronic lateral ankle instability. The authors presented in 2016 a new technique. In brief, they use a gracilis tendon autograft, which is fixed to the talus and calcaneus and tensioned through an oblique fibular tunnel using a suture button system. In the current study, they wanted to evaluate the functional results and complication rates using this technique with a minimum follow-up of 24 months. 34 patients were included in the retrospective study. All underwent all-inside endoscopic anatomic reconstruction of the ATFL and CFL in a technique described by the authors in 2016. The records were screened, amongst others, for complication rates, and the patient-rated outcome was assessed using the AOFAS score, Carson score, and the ankle activity score. The PROMs were assessed at a mean of 4 plus minus 1.6 years after surgery. The overall complication rate was 18%. One patient was reoperated for a hematoma, and 5 had removal of the fibular cortical fixation device because of discomfort. The PROMs assessed showed good to excellent results. The AOFAS score improved from 60 to 94 plus minus 6 points, the Carson score from 49 to 87 plus minus 10, and 97% of the patients returned to the same ankle activity score as preoperatively. The authors concluded that the technique ran satisfactory functional results at a minimum of 24 months, but the high rate of implant removal called for improvements of the design or positioning of the fibular cortical fixation device.
The second paper was published in Foot and Ankle International and entitled Arthroscopic Assisted versus All Arthroscopic Ankle Stabilization Technique by Gulfi et al. They used two different arthroscopic methods. The first technique, the so-called arthroscopic Broström procedure, two suture anchors are being placed arthroscopically into the anterior aspect of the distal fibula. The four sutures are passed through the skin in a safe zone between the peroneal tendons and the dorsal cutaneous nerve. Finally, they are shuttled percutaneously through an additional incision and tied. The second technique, the arthroscopic all-inside ligament repair, is performed through three portals. In brief, the talar ATFL remnant is augmented with a fiber wire and fixed to the distal tibia using a pushlock anchor. The authors included 39 consecutive patients, 20 of which were treated by one surgeon using the arthroscopic Broström procedure. The remaining 19 patients were treated by another surgeon using the arthroscopic all-inside ligament repair technique. Both groups did not differ per demographics or follow-up time. The authors again assessed, amongst others, the complication rate and the patient-rated outcome using the AOFAS score and the VAS. Significant more complications occurred in the arthroscopic Broström group. 40% of the patients in the arthroscopic Broström group suffered a complication. 4 patients reported a plantar flexion deficit of more than 10 degrees compared to the contralateral side. 3 patients suffered a transient neuritis of the superficial peroneal nerve, and 1 patient required anchor removal because of a prominent suture knot. Only 1 patient, which equals 5%, suffered a complication in the arthroscopic all-inside ligament repair group. This again was a plantar flexion deficit. For the clinical outcome scores, no significant differences were observed between the two techniques. At an average follow-up of 1.7 years after the surgery, the AOFAS score was about 92 points and the VAS 1 point on an 11-item Likert scale. The authors concluded that both techniques are suitable options, but the arthroscopic Broström procedure had a considerably higher complication rate.
Thank you, Hans, for this nice presentation. But let's talk about a few general limitations. Obviously, the first study was retrospective with all the associated limitations. But the authors apparently have a clinical protocol in place in which all patients are scored preoperatively. For the second study, it remained unclear to me whether it was prospective or retrospective. One limitation in both studies is that the authors do not report on concomitant intra-articular pathologies. But for the second study, this could be explained as the presence of a Taylor osteochondral lesion was an exclusion criteria identified by MRI, which again we know is not 100% sensitive. And while we were recording the podcast, we actually had a discussion on the different repair techniques. Could you maybe outline the three predominant repair techniques?
Thanks, Sebastian. So we distinguish three different repair techniques, namely the non-anatomic reconstruction, the anatomic reconstruction, and the direct repair. For all these three, we have arthroscopic techniques and open techniques. In general, the reconstruction is based on augmenting the ligaments using mainly tendons, while the direct repair uses the scar tissue and the ligament remnants to augment and fix the stability of the ligaments.
Thank you very much. I think I got it. The first study used a non-anatomical reconstruction. They harvested the gracilis tendon from the ipsilateral knee, obviously affecting a knee or a side of the body that would not have been affected if we would have done an anatomic repair. Overall, they report a return to previous activities of 97%. That sounds pretty high to me.
Yeah, that's pretty astonishing, actually. But we have two aspects. It's not only the donor site morbidity, but it's also the result at the ankle itself. Because previous studies showed by transplanting a ligament to the ankle, you will change the kinematics of the ankle. And therefore, a lot of previous studies showed inferior results for any reconstruction method against the direct repair. This is why the vast majority of authors nowadays consider the direct repair the gold standard. And the authors, as you stated, reported return to previous activity level of 97%. That's even for studies performing a direct repair outstanding. So I do not have a good explanation how they came up with these really good results.
Let's have a look at the arthroscopic Broström procedure. That is the predominant procedure we perform for our first cases, not for revision, but for the first. Galfi et al. Reported a complication rate of 40%, which is considerably high. We have not done the math on our cases yet, but I would assume that if we observe temporary superficial peroneal nerve neuritis in about 20% of the patients, that's something we would be aware of. Do you think the study is going to change our procedure?
That's a good point, and I fully agree with you. We have not systematically followed up our patients, but still we would have recognized such a really high complication rate, I'm sure. And we did not observe either the high superficial peroneal nerve injuries nor the high rate of limited range of motion. So maybe it's a technical aspect which might lead to this really, really high complication rate. I still believe that we should stick to the arthroscopic Broström, but we will definitely will be more aware for the range of motion and this kind of limitation in the future.
Maybe we're not aware enough of plantar flexion deficit, and this might be a limitation for certain sports groups that necessitate maximum plantar flexion, such as ballet dancers. And maybe in the future, we should have a look at the all-inside technique for certain cases, as those reports were really promising as well.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to this session of Ankle Surgery Update, Science Guiding Treatment. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did, and we hope you all will tune in next time. As always, you can find us on almost all podcast platforms, and feel free to follow us on FouchbeauLMO.